Do design decisions involve value judgments? Andy Halliwell has gone and posted this question on LinkedIn as part of our redesigning D&T project and debates. I think this is a really tricky one to answer, and our expert group felt that it was an important question that needed debating. Do design decisions involve value judgments? I think firstly, I'd be saying, what do you mean by a value judgment, a values judgment? And maybe in your response to Andy's question, you'll explore what you understand and what your views are of what value judgments are, and then whether they actually impinge on or affect the design decisions that designers make and also that children make in D&T lessons. So do join the debate. We're always open to conversation and discussion on this. But for now, on to the next episode. This week's episode is another one in the PAP 40 series, and this time I'm joined by Phil Jones, who's kind of going to be wearing multiple hats, I think, during this podcast recording. We never got to meet because obviously I never made it to PAT, but we had lots of virtual meetings before the conference. So Phil's going to talk about a paper that grabbed his attention, but I'm also going to ask him some questions about his involvement in PAT and some research that he's doing as well. So Phil, can you start off just by saying who you are, where you are and what you do?
Yeah, so I'm a full-time D&T teacher, subject leader at a school in Merseyside, an all-girls school. I'm also a part-time D student at Liverpool John Moores University, where I focus on 21st century skills and curriculum development in D&T, which is quite all-encompassing, difficult to juggle everything, but I'm just about managing at the moment.
Yeah, and looking at the photographs you've got over your shoulder, you've obviously got, you know, a full family life as well. So
Yes.
So you're kind of showing that it can be done, but we maybe come on to a little bit about how you're managing all of that later on. So we got to meet each other a little bit virtually, didn't we, in the run up to the PAT conference. Matt McLean, who chaired the conference, is also one of your supervisors. Is that right?
He is. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So Matt roped you into the conference. So what was your role and how did you find the conference in terms of being an organiser as well as a participant?
Well, Matt sort of sold this conference to me at the very beginning. So when he first became my supervisor, he said, oh, there's this conference going on, which I'd never heard of. Up until then, he said, oh, there's D&T teachers from all over the world that come along and we're hosting it in Liverpool, so it was ideal for me being local. And he just said, would you be part of the organising committee for it? So I just said yes. I mean, not one to say no to things, really. I often struggle with later. So he just said, you wanted to take part in this, and then sort of started meeting weekly, didn't we? Chatting about all, you know, the focus and the dates for things and what strands would be. And then later on, he asked whether they wanted to do some sort of social events, you know, organising those with a couple of my other EdD colleagues, so Sarah and Cal. And then we sort of cracked on with that in the background, really. So it was quite an interesting, I suppose, an opportunity. It was an opportunity, you know, something a little bit different. And the conference itself was really enjoyable to actually go, but also be part of shaping it as well.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, the social events are kind of a big part of the PAT conference in terms of it's just informal time, isn't it, as much for people to chat and catch up, because it's quite a community. Yeah, and your response there about you'd never heard of PAT before, it's not unusual. It can be quite a difficult conference series to find online. So I will put some links in the show notes to the conference. But yeah, it was a full-on week, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. I only managed to go for a couple of days because it was in term time for me. So it's always difficult for teachers to get out, isn't it, for any kind of CPD, really. But yeah, I managed to get 2 days and I managed to pack those 2 days full. Lots of different papers that I want to see being presented, different events. So yeah, it was packed full, but it was really, really enjoyable.
So you've picked a paper. I know there was two or three papers that you'd have quite happily chatted about, but you've picked this one. Let me have a look. It's by Remke Klapwijk. I'm sure I've said that wrong. From the Netherlands, called, and the title is "Secondary Students' Intrinsic Motivation During Multidisciplinary STEAM Projects." I'm not going to read the second part of it because it's actually quite a long title. I'm assuming that you heard Remke present this paper.
Yes, I did. Yeah. I was drawn to the multidisciplinary aspect of it because that's part of, I suppose it's related to my own research as well, but I like the idea of a teamwork project. So that's what drew me to that one.
Because yours is all about 21st century skills. And so that link of things that are across different subjects, I suppose I can see how that appealed to you. Could you just give us a quick summary of the paper? Oh, God, I feel like I'm putting you on a test there.
So it's a it was a small study. Hang on, you'll have to take that one out. It's not that small, really. So it was a study of students, which was quite rare for the conference. It was really focusing on students and how they felt in relation to their motivations, really. So what they did, they took part in a multidisciplinary project in teams through this Technasia curriculum. So in the Netherlands, there's about 100 schools that have a Technasia curriculum. It's a little bit like a UTC in England.
So for people who don't know what a UTC is, that's a university technical college.
Go on.
No, I'm just saying that because there are international listeners who won't know about Technasia or UTCs as well. What's a Technasia?
So a Technasia, it's a little bit like a technical curriculum, I suppose. They pick strands where they're interested in, and the Technasia aspect of it is teachers are trained. They get like a special certification to become a Technasian teacher, and they bring in their own expertise. So it could be they might be a maths teacher, or they might have been an engineer or an architect or anything like that. And they're trained to bring these real life problems to the classroom, and they work quite intensively. The students work quite intensively on this. So these are aged about 14 to 16, I think. And they're working in these projects to solve a real issue for a company, usually. And it's up to the teacher to find these companies or problems, which is very, very similar to what I'm looking at. So, again, that was my motivation to find out a bit more about this. So in terms of the paper, they looked at intrinsic motivation theory using a questionnaire. They looked at 182 students, looking at things like how much they enjoyed this project, what their choices were, how much they valued it, and so on. And I won't tell you what they found till later.
You're not going to reveal the punchline or did it. Yeah, it was quite interesting, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. So, I mean, I thought it was... I think this whole thing about intrinsic motivation is really fascinating. This, you know, about what drives the individual to engage with something. And they draw on Eccles and Wigfield's theory about expectancy value theory, don't they? Which if you work in education, this is not to be exclusive to people, but is quite a familiar one. About students' beliefs about themselves and their motivations to take part in different tasks and activities and how they feel about their success and such. So, yeah, it's got some really, she writes a really nice, succinct description of that theory on pages 2 and 3 of her paper. So I'd really recommend to people to have a read of that because I think understanding some of the theory around motivation, and it has been tested, this theory, so there is truth in this theory, because the logic is, if it's theory, it's not always being tested in academic world. I think Remke's description here is really good and insightful, and I think that might help some teachers who are listening think about what motivates children to engage in different tasks as well. I think then later on in the paper, she talks about how she measures this, doesn't she? She's got this intrinsic motivation inventory, which she says is a questionnaire. Okay, so let's take away the fancy language about inventory. But it's a questionnaire that's measuring children's intrinsic motivation. Again, what's really interesting about this survey, this questionnaire, is it's available online. So again, teachers can use it and teachers can adapt it. And I think Remke, on page 6 of her paper, gives a really nice description about how she modifies that questionnaire to fit what she's doing. I don't know, do you have any thoughts about that, Phil?
I thought it was a great idea to use a tool that's already out there. I mean, one of the things that teachers are guilty of is, you know, start making everything from scratch. And yes. I'm certainly guilty of that. And, you know, why not use something that not only is out there, but it's validated, you know, it's been checked that it's measuring the right things in the right way. Mm. It's balanced. So, yeah, use it. And, I mean, I suppose part of the issue with tools like this is, how, you know, what do you do with the data you've collected then? And, yeah. And she does talk about how that's done as well, which is useful.
Yes. And that's, I think, where teachers can actually link up with, you know, D&T teachers could link up with other teachers, with math teachers, maybe, who might be able to help with some of the analysis.
Maybe.
Because I have to say, this would, you know, and I've got A-level maths, but this would blow my head off. I might have to go to my brother, who's got a PhD in maths, but he would probably then try and overcomplicate it for me. And I have got some really good books. I'm just looking to my right. It's my newly catalogued library. I might put a photograph of this in the show notes. I have Dewey systemed the whole of my academic books at home. I obviously haven't got enough to
that's
do.
That's commitments, yeah.
I think it was while I was recovering from my ruptured Achilles, I kind of got my label maker out and got a bit carried away, really. But yeah, I've got a couple of books up here, so I'm going to lose people and lose the sound as I move away. For, you know, if you're a non-statistical person, how to do statistical analysis of your data. So yeah, there are lots of simplistic guides out there. To do this. But no, I think it's, and she explains it actually again quite clearly. And I love Remke's writing. She's done some really interesting projects on making design thinking explicit. I know Drew Wicken in this country has been involved in that as well. She's got some really good stuff. And if people have been along to the D&T Association's research meets, Remke and Gerald, who she works with sometimes on the projects in the Netherlands, kind of came along and talked about some of their work. Anyway, I'm digressing there. Do we want to get to the findings and the punchline then, Phil, about this paper?
through the survey, so they did a paired t-test statistically to kind of get a, you know, some significance there. Like a, it's almost like an effect size, isn't it, using a paired t-test. And they found that there wasn't really any effect on motivation by doing this project. I mean, they hypothesised at the beginning that doing an integrated STEAM project would increase motivation, but actually it didn't. But that's not to say that it's not worthwhile, though.
Yes, yeah, and it's also not to say that the opposite is true, that if it's not multidisciplinary, that they would be motivated. I think people have got to be really careful. It's just in this situation, they had this idea, this view at the start, and they were going to test it, that multidisciplinary STEAM projects would lead to high intrinsic motivation. And it didn't, which I think, yeah, I think that would really surprise. And given the sample size, the number of participants, it's not like one class. This was quite a number of different classes taking part in this. But I suppose what it does do, if you're a teacher, it causes you to question some of your assumptions that we make about multidisciplinary and application of knowledge, that we're claiming we're doing design and technology from other subjects. We actually have our own knowledge base in design and technology. We do draw on other subjects as other subjects draw on us. But anyway, there we go. Whole other conversation going off on one. But it does sort of challenge. But they did have some other things, didn't they, that they pulled out that were, I would say, more positive, but had other implications as well for practice, didn't they, for teaching? Do you want to tease for any of those things? About the jigsaw technique, wasn't there?
Yeah, so they used a technique called the jigsaw technique, which I believe is from the National Strategies, which I do have. I actually do have that quite a big folder, wasn't it, that was given out. What year was it? About 2000 or something?
I think it was 2001. I think it was when I was teaching in Corby. It was kind of really coming out. They do a nice diagram in the paper, don't they, to explain it?
Yeah, they do, yeah. And I'd not heard it before. I mean, I've been teaching for 11 years now, so I'm sort of, much later than that. And it's, I think teaching is one of those things where things come full circle, don't they, quite regularly. So using those strategies would be useful. And it has motivated me to, remember when I get a chance to have a look at those documents. But yeah, I've had it for a good while, but I've just not had a chance to look at it, to be honest. But I will.
Yeah, and if I can find it, it's actually in the National Archive now online. It's not available on the government website anymore because it came from the Labour government. The Conservative and the Coalition governments went to change of government, and it moved the curriculum and teacher training in this country in England has gone from focusing on pedagogy to more focusing on knowledge and the curriculum and what we teach. So yes, that is interesting how things come around, and it's interesting how another country is now doing this work on pedagogy as well. She talks as well, doesn't she, about the having clients for part of the project, that designing for somebody else, that was a motivation as well, and did cause enjoyment as well as sort of fulfillment for the students, didn't it?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that's part of the intrinsic motivation, is that it's, are they motivated by the fact they enjoy doing it? So there's no external factors from it. They're doing it because they want to do it, they're doing it because they enjoy it. And they did get that from the survey, yeah.
I keep losing you as well, so I'm going to have to go through
it. Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? I don't know. Yeah, it keeps bopping off.
I think it's, I don't know whether it's, whether the bandwidth is able to cope with when I've got PDFs open online. So I've got the paper open.
I try to close everything off now.
Yeah. Anyway. So that's the paper. There's a few things there that I think that teachers can take away. It resonated with you because of your study. So you've hinted at it. 21st century skills, curriculum. So what's your research question or your hypothesis or your aim?
The aim is, I can tell you what the title is if you like. So the title is...
Today. The title today. That's what I always used to say to my doctoral students. Yeah.
Yeah. Today it's... hang on a minute. I'm going to have to get it. I actually have it in my bag.
Never put a doctoral student on the spot because they're always frightened about getting it, about misremembering, particularly if their supervisor might be listening. Oh, don't worry, Phil. What is it that you're exploring? Don't worry about getting the title.
I'm exploring design thinking at Key Stage 3 D&T and the relationship between skills and knowledge. So how do we foster 21st century skills like collaboration and problem solving and things at the same time as subject-specific knowledge? Where does that come in?
Right.
Through collaborative problem solving, so working in teams at Key Stage 3. And it's been brilliant. The actual project is very engaging. The writing of it, not so much. but the actually doing it is really, it's great. Yeah, really, really good.
And so how far in are you?
So I'm about halfway through. I mean, I've done my introductory chapter, my lit review, part of my methodology, and I've done all my data collection. So it's a case of analysing that now and sort of pulling everything together. So yeah, it's been challenging. It's definitely tricky balancing everything. Teaching and family and everything.
Yeah, so how have you collected the data and who have you collected the data with?
So I've used pupils at my school. I also used a validated instrument that somebody else has made. It's an American instrument that I used. I've also done portfolios, presentations, students' field notes, and focus groups. So that it's mixed methods.
Wow. And so that's some data you've got to analyse and make sense of. So you're having to be really organised.
Try.
I think when I was doing my doctorate, I would pretend sometimes that reorganising the folders and my files, and you can possibly see just over my corner, there's some files at the bottom of the cupboard. Those are some of my doctoral notes that I finished 6 years ago, 7 years ago, and I still can't bear to get rid of them.
Yeah, and there's a lot of blood, sweat and tears in those notes.
Yeah, there are, and it's painful. It's painful to get rid of them. So why did you decide to go for collecting all those different forms of data? What was the thinking behind that?
Because I'm following it, I decided to go for a case study, like a collective case study. So I wanted to collect as much data as I could because it's not a quantitative study. It's because it is a little bit, I suppose. It's mixed. I just wanted to get a picture of how each team, so I've done a random sample really of all of these different teams. So there's 160 pupils in each year. In it's year eight that I'm doing the study with. So they're all working in teams of four. So that's 40 teams, 40 different projects over an academic year.
Wow.
Obviously, that's way too big. So I've done a random sample of those. But I wanted to see, you know, what are the similarities? What are the differences between these? You know, does the context for that particular group change the way skills and knowledge have developed? So it's how can I measure that? There's no other way of doing it other than a range of methods.
Yeah. Yeah, and I suppose that helps you kind of just confirm what you're seeing in one part of somewhere else or have it challenged. To kind of check things out that you're not, you know, I mean, for example, Remke could have, you know, might well have then gone in with a bias or an assumption. And I suppose by having, she used a validated tool and statistics, you're using a variety of, you know, qualitative methods, you know, interpreting what you're seeing and what you're hearing, and having those different variety kind of gives validity in a different way to your study. So when do you hope to finish?
Well, it needs to be finished by, I think, May 25, I think.
Right.
No, it might even be 26. I don't know.
Oh!
I don't know. There's plenty of time. Plenty of time.
Yeah, either way, there's plenty of time, but I'd maybe be working out before sooner rather than later, because 12 months is quite a big difference. But yeah. So would you advocate to other D&T teachers who've got a master's to do a doctoral study, or if they haven't got a master's, to do a master's in study and do some research?
I would, yeah. I mean, it's hard, but it's nice to get your teeth stuck into something, and really it's enabled me to look back at, you know, what were the roots of the subject, you know, in the late 80s, and what were all the issues in the 90s and so on, which I wouldn't necessarily have appreciated had I not started this particular course. So it's nice to be able to get a better understanding of your own subject as well, because it is quite different to all the other subjects. My D&T is very unique, and in a bit of trouble at the moment. So I think the more people that are researching it, the better.
Yeah, it gives an evidence base of what impact the subject does. And what I really like, Phil, about your study is the fact that you're like Remke's, you're involving children. One thing that I noticed when we looked at the paper conferences is how few actually, whether children or the children's work or the children's voice was the data. So yes, that's really exciting that you're using that. So you're going to present at the next PAC conference in China.
Oh, I don't think they'll let me out for that long, unless it's in the summer holidays, maybe. Do you know what? I actually would like to. I did enjoy presenting at this PAC conference. It was nerve-wracking, but I'm glad I did it. And I managed to get everything across, pretty much a pilot version of my actual study. So it was good to get the feedback. You know, there was some really interesting points that were raised afterwards, which helped shape my study.
Yeah, that's a really good thing about presenting, actually standing up and sharing it. Yet the process of putting together the presentation helps you shape your thoughts, doesn't it, as well as then standing and saying it, and then some of the feedback you get. I mean, at one of the PAC conferences, somebody asked me a question, and it did quite a big shift in some of the conceptual part of my study. And that's priceless, getting that feedback and that engagement.
Yeah, I mean, and following the conference, Hilda Ruth Beaumont got in touch with me, just asking a couple of questions. Or here are my thoughts, and that was a couple of weeks later, and it really got me thinking about knowledge and how that fits into the picture.
Yeah,
and again, that completely changed my focus then to something that's much more meaningful, I suppose, to the subject as it stands now, with all of the knowledge focus, and it's kind of bringing things in to make it more relevant.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's great to hear. That's great to hear about, you know, sort of start to finish of the PAC conference, from you kind of getting involved, organising, taking part, listening, and then you getting involved and sharing your research. I think that's been great. So thanks very much, Phil, for your time and sharing that. And patience, thank you very much to people who've listened. If we've not managed to edit out all of the glitches that we had along the way, but either way, stick with it. You know, glad people have stuck with it. And, you know, I think they've got a lot from you coming on the podcast this week, Phil. Thanks ever so much.
You're very welcome. Cheers.